This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates that relate to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wild lands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing George Werthner. George is an ecologist, a writer, and a photographer who studied and written about and photographed natural habitats in many American locales, especially in the mountains of many parts of the United States, but especially the Rockies of the West. He holds degrees from the University of Montana and the University of California in Santa Cruz. He's worked many places in the U.S. from border to border. He specializes in studying predators. He's the author of 38 books and innumerable articles that have been published in a variety of magazines, including the National Geographic. So, welcome, George. Good to be talking to you again.
Good to talk with you.
Want to talk about Yellowstone today. So, Yellowstone Park was established in 1872 as the world's first national park. So, George, what were the reasons that Congress had in mind to establish the park? What was going on?
Well, there's a couple of things. It was late to be, you might say, officially explored by any government representatives. There have been fur trappers and, of course, Indians who had traversed it for centuries. But in terms of knowledge of the larger public, it was the result of several expeditions, both private and public, that went in there in the early 1869, 1870, 1871.
Uh-huh.
And as the news got out about the thermal features in particular, the realization that this was significant. In fact, it is one of the largest collections of thermal features in the whole world. And so that geysers, hot springs, et cetera, was the main reason for setting aside. If you look at the boundaries, most of the park is a square. And the idea was to, the park boundaries were square, and the idea was to encompass the majority of thermal reaches. And today, we recognize it as almost, or maybe even more significantly, for the wildlife. But however, in 1872, you know, wildlife was still pretty abundant in around the West. You know, the big bison herds hadn't been, you know, completely eliminated yet. You could usually go off and see elk and deer and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not originally set aside for wildlife, even though today most people would say that's probably one of the best things about Yellowstone.
All right.
The other thing that I think is really significant for people to understand is how unusual it was for Congress to even set aside any land in 1872. This was just after the Civil War, post-Civil War, and Congress at that time in the 1860s passed all these laws in the early 1870s to transfer land to private entities. So you had the Homestead Act, you had the Timber and Stone Act, you had the railroad grants, you had the Mining Law of 1872. All these were designed to get the West settled, to help assist settlement, and to take public lands and put it in federal lands and put it into private hands. So in the midst of all that idea of we want to, you know, hasten resource exploitation, they set aside this one area and said, well, we're going to do something different here. We're not going to privatize it, and we're not going to put it up for exploitation, which, you know, in the day, when you think about it, was pretty amazing. And so I think that's one of the more significant things about the establishment of Yellowstone. And we didn't have any other national parks established until the 1890s. So it was sort of unique in that whole time period. It wasn't part of a larger let's create national parks movement.
Right.
It was really significant to Yellowstone and specific.
Well, the Army was assigned as the custodian of the park at the beginning. How well did the Army perform in doing that job?
Well, yeah. Now, back up a little bit. When it was first established in 1872, Congress allotted almost no money for any kind of maintenance or oversight or whatever. They had the first 14 years, they just had a half-time superintendent and a few seasonal workers, and that was it. And one of the problems that happened during that time period was, there was a lot of poaching of wildlife. Well, actually, in fact, at first it was legal to hunt for your food, but there was also a significant amount of poaching, like bison were getting poached, which they were trying to protect, and elk were being shot for their hides. And
wolves particularly.
And during that time, of course, a half-time superintendent couldn't do much about that. And so in 1886, I think it was, the Army was assigned to patrol Yellowstone, and part of the reason for that was to try to stop the poaching. And they were also assigned the job of sort of, you might say, facilitating visitor use of the land by creating the roads, the present road system, the circular road system that goes to Old Faithful mm-hmm. and to the lake and the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone. That basic route was established by the U.S. Army.
Uh-huh.
And they built bridges and so forth. And then they would go on patrols in the wintertime. They built cabins and for patrol parties to stay in. And they did significantly reduce the amount of wildlife killing. And by the 1890s and early 1900s, wildlife was actually, by then, getting rare around the West. I wrote a book about Idaho mountain ranges years ago, but in doing the research for it, I came upon an article, I think it was like 1908 or something like that, and the headline was, "Three deer sighted in Bannock County," which is where Pocatello, Idaho is.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so rare to see deer, it was like a headlines in the paper.
Yeah.
And that was due to, in those early days, either territorial government or state government, there was no rules about hunting. You could hunt year-round and take as many animals as you want, so the wildlife suffered. And so that made it even more valuable for Yellowstone's wildlife. In fact, a lot of the elk herds around the West that we have today, including like up in the Canadian Rockies and Banff, down in Colorado, and Arizona and other places, were the result of transplants from Yellowstone's elk herds.
Okay.
Were the source of the, because in all those states, elk were either totally extirpated or were so rare that they wanted to supplement the populations.
Right. Well, the park is 2.2 million acres, and the boundary that was established in at the beginning, is that still the same boundary, or has it been changed somewhat?
Well, it changed a little bit. They added on the north part by Gardner. They bought some land in the 1930s, ranch land, and added it to the park. And that's why that part of the boundary is a little different. And, talk about a loss. There was an attempt. The Forbes, Malcolm Forbes, owned a big chunk of land just north of that. And there was a hope to acquire it, and federal acquisition processes are slow, and the Church Universal came in and offered money for it, 33,000 acres, I think it was, and acquired it. So that was kind of a lost opportunity. That would have been an acquisition of a lot of nice winter range. But if you go in that northern section of the park by Gardner, you can still see the old irrigation ditches and so forth from when it was a ranch.
So what was the basis for establishing the park or boundary? You said it was essentially a square, although it's very very rough on the east side. But what was the basis for where that boundary was established?
Well, on the east side, it was a watershed divide. So, you know, the streams that flow into the Clark Fork of the Yellowstone and the Shoshone River there going eastward was the watershed divide, and then the headwaters of the Yellowstone, the Lamar and so forth, was the headwaters of that, was the other part of the divide there. And then that was established a little later, because again, it was originally a square, but it was established a little later. And then this kind of interesting thing was the first national forest, they weren't called that, they were called forest reserves, but the first predecessor of national forest, the Yellowstone Forest Reserve, took in the eastern portion of what is now the boundary and beyond the east there of the Shoshone National Forest. And that was a recognition, this gets back to the wildlife, a recognition that wildlife migrated out of what was the park, and so the creation of the Yellowstone Forest Reserve was primarily a wildlife thing to protect the migration route of elk coming out of Yellowstone.
Mm. So what about the south and the west, where it's essentially a straight line?
Yeah. They didn't adjust that at all, but there is, as you probably know, protected lands to the south and west. South is the Teton Wilderness, which was, again, part of the forest reserves that were established early on. And then you have the John D. Rockefeller Parkway boundary, and then the Targhee National Forest boundary on the sort of southwest corner. And all those national forests, the original ones, this is a fun story, too. They were all established originally primarily to protect watersheds, not for logging or anything else. And that was the justification for them. And when they were originally being created, a president could declare a national forest reserve by executive proclamation, much as the Antiquities Act allows presidents to create national monuments today. And so one of the consequences of that was Western senators in general were like they are today, where they're, you know, like guys like Senator Lee in Utah wants to sell off public land because he doesn't like public lands, thinks it's bad. That attitude existed even more so back in the 1890s and early 1900s when presidents were using that privilege to create national forests. So anyway, Teddy Roosevelt, by the time Teddy Roosevelt was president in early 1900s, they passed a law saying no more presidential proclamations of national forests. And so, and Teddy Roosevelt knew he didn't have enough votes to overturn it in the Senate if he vetoed it, so it would become law anyway. So he declared, he got Gifford Pinchot, who became the first chief of the Forest Service, to come in, and they put out maps of the West and drew lines all over the maps of the West. And then this law, this bill that Congress had passed was going to become law the next morning. And he signed a proclamation before that establishing 16 million acres of new national forest. Then he signed the bill saying he wasn't allowed to make any more. So when the Congress woke up the next morning, they saw that he signed this bill prohibiting the president from making any more national forests. But then they learned that he created a whole bunch of new ones. Anyway.
So up in the northwest corner of the park, it's an irregular boundary that includes Electric Peak. How did that happen?
That was part of the, I think, out of the acquisition of the private ranch. But I'm not 100% sure. But I think that was all part of that bunch of land north of Gardner.
So was wildlife an important consideration in the establishment of the boundaries?
Well, no, and that's part of the problem. You know, it was originally to encompass the geothermal stuff, and so, you know, if we were to redraw the boundaries today, we'd expand them greatly. In fact, one of the things I think we should do is have a greater Yellowstone ecosystem national park and take in a lot of the surrounding lands that are Forest Service and put it under Park Service management. But what we would, and also make an effort to, rather than sell off public lands, acquire more of the private lands as they come up for sale. You know, there has been efforts over the years. For example, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation has added significantly to the amount of wildlife land north of Yellowstone there, like the Dome Mountain Wildlife Management Area has been added to, and other parcels bought up to protect it for elk migration. And you have some landowners who are very sympathetic to wildlife, too, that own property north of the park. But still, on a lot of sides, we could really benefit for having more of the area managed for biodiversity protection rather than any kind of resource extraction like logging or whatever else might be going on under alternative management of the Forest Service and BLM.
So you're not happy with the way the boundary runs right now. What criteria would you use to expand the boundary?
Well, you know, I would make the point that Yellowstone is a globally significant, you know, it is a biodiversity preserve, global international significance area designated, and I would argue that because of that, in order to protect the ecological function of the ecosystem, we need to have more consistent management. One of the problems you have when you have state management, Forest Service, BLM, Fish and Wildlife, and Park Service, there's no consistent management. You know, the animals don't know when they cross the boundary from, say, National Park Service land to National Forest land or to state land or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, maybe of any place in the United States, we ought to be giving the benefit of the doubt or defer to protecting the ecosystem integrity. And I think the Park Service, on the whole, is the best agency for managing for that, because their general mission is to protect these landscapes' ecological function, whereas, you know, the Forest Service or the BLM, they have grazing, they have logging, they have other mandates that compromise that biodiversity protection. So if I were king, which I'm not, but if I could, I would proclaim the whole Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the public lands, as part of the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem National Park and Preserve. And a preserve, by the way, is another management thing that is allowed with national parks, where you can have things like hunting still allowed and some other modest kinds of uses that might be prohibited in general. And I would throw an overlay of wilderness on top of it all. So that's the Wilderness Act, of course, prohibits wheeled vehicles and,
right,
and machinery. So
right,
I would try to do that on all of it. So anyway, that's what we should be looking at. This is not just any old place on the whole planet. There's nothing like it. There's no place in the United States with the wildlife that we find in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. There's no place in the United States with, and in the whole world, with so much thermal activity. And of course, it's great scenery and has you know, watershed values and so forth. So we really need to recognize that and give it the kind of protection that it deserves, in my view.
Well, I've heard some suggestion that there be a buffer zone around the current border of the park, maybe extending, I think I've heard, 13 miles or something like that. How would you feel about that?
Well, that'd be better than the existing. I mean, for example, the Forest Service is going to log a bunch of trees up by Cook City. That's 2 miles, 3 miles from the park border, as part of this, you know, emergency logging mandate from the from President Trump. And of course, as you're aware, there's plans to log in the Gallatin Range and down by, there was a proposal right by West Yellowstone, right on the park border, to log there, which I think is put on hold for now, or was set back. But those kinds of things are ongoing threats, and who knows what it'll be in 10 years. And so a buffer would be great, but again, why not just change the management to the Park Service?
All right. Well, on the east side of the park, all the way around the park, there are national forest lands. So how far into each of those national forests do you think you should go? You can't actually do a watershed on the east side, because the park boundary currently is already on a downslope, isn't it?
I would just use the boundaries of the generalized boundaries for the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, which usually is defined as going down to the edge of where the junction or borders of private and public lands in this area surrounding immediately the park. So that would go down to the Tetons and take in, you know, part of the Bridger-Teton National Forest. It would include, you know, the fish and wildlife lands like the Centennial Valley with Red Rocks Lakes Wildlife Refuge, and, you know, even some BLM lands like the Madison River north of Ennis Lake. And I would just use that as my general criteria for setting aside a protected area. And it would be about, you know, the general definition, depending upon where you found the boundaries, of course, and there's various definitions, would be about 23 million acres. And that may sound like a lot, but it's not a lot in terms of what is possible. China just created a new national park, 47 million acres.
Oh, really?
47 million acres.
Wow.
So, I mean, if China can do it, let's get in a little competition with China here, huh? and try to at least keep up with them. The idea being that, again, this is global significance, and we really should recognize this. It's not like any other part of the West. There are lots of other significant places in the West, but you do not have such a collection of wildlife, scenery, biodiversity, all the native species that were originally there can still be found. You can just go on and on with all the superlatives.
Right. Well, let's talk about the political issue here. What kind of support is there? Is there support among various environmental groups like Wilderness Society or National Wildlife Federation?
I've never heard any of them suggest such an ambitious plan as protecting the whole ecosystem.
Uh-huh.
They, of course, do recognize that it is an important area, so they recognize that the Great Yellowstone is significant, but the approach seems to be more piecemeal, you know, like, okay, we'll try to keep oil and gas, you know, development from happening in the Wyoming range, and we just deal with that. We want to stop, a gold mine by
Gardner,
by Immigrant Peak or by Gardner, and we deal with that. And you're going to be doing that forever.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it'd be a lot easier to advocate for a major protected area that would eliminate all those threats for good, hopefully, and not have to deal with this stuff piecemeal one time after another. And you don't succeed all the time either.
Do you think there would be any local support for it? West Yellowstone.
I do think so, especially if you did this combination of park and preserve, because there is a significant amount of the local population that likes to hunt, and there would still be, that's one of the things you can do in a preserve, but it's under Park Service jurisdiction, and so things like wolves would not be getting hunted, and grizzly bears if it were under the Park Service. But, you know, there would probably still be elk hunting and deer hunting and that sort of thing, but maybe more regulated than under the current situation. And the other thing is, you know, I don't like to make a big deal about this, but as you know, and most people know anymore, Yellowstone is a major economic factor in the local community.
Uh-huh.
And if you had, like, the world's, you know, most globally significant ecosystem protected into the future, I can't help but think that that would be good for local economies as well. It gives you some influence on what happens, hopefully, outside. I mean, you could write up legislation that says anything. You could have legislation that says any significant parcels of land that may come up for sale on the borders of the ecosystem, the federal government is authorized to try to acquire it. You know, you could have that part of your thing, and that way you could eliminate the chances of random subdivisions right on the border of Yellowstone. It wouldn't necessarily preclude it, but it would give you one more tool in the toolbox to protect against those kinds of things.
So what kind of political support do you think there might be for this? Any members of Congress? I kind of doubt that any the state legislatures would be supportive.
Right, right. No, you're absolutely right. I think that... But, you know, a lot of these things, you have to start out with the idea and start pushing it. And, I mean, the Wilderness Act, for example, took many years before it was passed as legislation.
Uh-huh.
Many of our national parks, you know, the Alaska Lands Act passed in the 1980s. And some, you know, Bob Marshall proposed that the Central Birch Range be set aside as a national park in the 1930s. It took 50 years before it happened. But because he put out that idea... It sort of percolated along. It percolated along, looking for the right moment. And what I find with a lot of conservation, it's kind of like serendipitous factors line up, and then suddenly you get legislation passed. But you can never tell when that moment is going to happen. So you have to have something prepared and ready to go. So when the situation is such, like I'll use the Alaska Lands Act. Most people don't know this, but the whole reason we have new national parks in Alaska in 1980 mm-hmm. was because of the Alaska pipeline.
Uh-huh.
And the pipeline companies wanted to build a pipeline to Valdez from Prudhoe Bay. And they were going to cross some native lands. And the native people said, well, you know, we're not going to allow it. So the pipeline companies went to Congress and said, you've got to resolve these land issues. And one of the ways they resolved it, besides transferring 44 million acres to native people in Alaska, they also designate a bunch of new national parks.
Uh-huh.
But those national parks would not have happened if people hadn't been already suggesting and thinking about creating new national parks.
So I want to ask you about another issue that's a bit of a departure. The Department of Justice said this week that the president has the ability to nullify some of the national monuments, and there used to be a Teton National Monument that's now incorporated into the park, but There are other national marine monuments, a lot of them around the West. How do you take a look at that that issue? Do you think the Department of Justice is carrying any weight on that?
I'm not surprised that the Trump Department of Justice came out with such a decision, since they seem to do pretty much whatever Trump tells them to do. But hopefully that will be taken to the courts, and the Supreme Court might rule against that. That would be one thing. And then even if they rule that it is possible for him to extinguish these national monuments, I think at least of the ones that were created, that future presidents will reestablish them. Even Congress may reestablish them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people don't realize most of our national parks in the West were originally national monuments.
Uh-huh.
You know, Zion National Park, Death Valley National Park, Joshua Tree National Park, Saguaro National Park. I could go down this long, Olympic National Park. A whole lot of the places that people today value were originally national monuments.
Uh-huh.
And so I just can't help but think that a lot of these would be recreated even if Trump was able to eliminate them. The only downside is during the time between he disallows them and the time when they could be reprotected, you know, a lot of exploitation could happen. Like, for example, you could lease for oil and gas leases, and when that's a oil and gas lease, it's a contract. So if you want to eliminate them, you got to buy them out, and often at a much higher price, just like the gold mine that was eliminated by Cook City years ago. The mining companies acquired it for $2.50 and $5 an acre under the mining laws from 1872, and we had to pay them millions to get back those mining leases,
right.
So mining claims. So anyway, that's the downside, but I can't see that it would long-lasting. I think that ultimately Congress and maybe
restored.
A future president would reestablish them.
Yeah. Well, George, it sounds to me like there needs to be a strong political lobby to support the expansion of Yellowstone's area and to support the national retention of the national monuments and overcome the objections of the Trump regime. Well, George, thank you very much. It's been great to talk to you again. Important issue. I worked in Yellowstone one time, and I just love the park. It's fabulous. I'd like to see it expanded. So,
well, I just end with one thing. I've been to over 200 national park units, and my favorite place on the whole planet is Yellowstone.
Uh-huh.
So it's a very important place to me
right.
as well.
Well, George, our guest today has been ecologist, writer, and photographer George Werzner. He's also specialized in studying wildfires, and he's written extensively about wildfires as a critic of the government policy. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found at its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com. Scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.